Hello everyone!
This week on How'd You Become So Awesome, we're interviewing Dr. Lois Frankel.
Lois is perhaps best known as the New York Times best-selling author of Nice Girls Don't Get the Corner Office.
And she's also written a stack of other popular titles in the field of female corporate success and leadership,
such as Nice Girls Don't Get Rich and See Jane Lead.
Lois is an internationally recognized expert in the field, and through both her own executive career coaching company and a not-for-profit organization she set up herself, she's helped thousands of women and girls achieve their career aspirations.
Welcome to the show, Lois, and thank you so much for your time. As you already know, we're huge fans of your work.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to be on. I'm just delighted.
Okay, so Lois, for the people at home who may not have read any of your books yet, can you tell us in your own words what you're all about?
Yeah, what I'm all about is helping people to get and keep the jobs they want. And what that means specifically for women is helping women understand what are some of the ways that they unconsciously sabotage themselves by acting in ways that are stereotypically nice girl behaviors. And so when people say to me, and they do say this to me all the time, I've walked by your books on the bookshelf, Nice Girls Don't Get the Corner Office, Nice Girls Don't Get Rich, Nice Girls Just Don't Get It. And I always thought that I wouldn't pick up the book because you were going to tell me I had to be mean and nasty. And nothing could be further from the truth. The fact is that we all have to be nice to be successful, but you can't be that nice little girl you were taught to be in childhood and expect to achieve your adult goals. So my work with women is really around helping them see the ways in which they act stereotypically and how they could add some new behaviors to their skill sets that aren't masculine but are more adult female behaviors.
Can I ask, what's wrong with being a nice girl? What is the consequence of keeping those nice girl behaviors?
Yeah, when you act like that nice little girl you were taught to be in childhood, people don't take you seriously. You don't ask for what you want. You tend to be seen as somebody who may be a really hard worker, but not promotable material. You may make miracles, but miracle workers get canonized, not recognized. So that when you act in these stereotypically nice girl ways, it really does diminish your ability to exude self-confidence and credibility that's required for career success.
I think one of the most powerful things about reading your book, Nice Girls Don't Get the Corner Office, for me was realizing that you get socialized to be a girl, but then you don't actually evolve into a woman often.
Yeah, you know, it's very true, isn't it? I mean, when you look at what boys are taught in childhood, boys are taught things like, don't let anybody take advantage of you, be tough, don't cry. And I'm not saying all of those are necessarily good messages to give little boys, but those messages later in life don't require a segue to them because they learned in childhood what it means to behave like a man, essentially, because we don't really have nice boy behaviors, right? We have nice girl behaviors. And so, for women, it is hard to make that transition because you have to give yourself permission to do it. Nobody gives you permission to become a woman. As a matter of fact, I don't remember who said it, but there was a famous quote that we are not born women, but we become women. And, you know, I think women need to really take that to heart.
What are the top three career sabotages that women are making these days that you're seeing a lot?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure it's changed that much in the past 30 years. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't have written the book if I thought it did, and I talk about that in the introduction to the book. But in terms of the top three sabotagers, number one is this thing about not negotiating, because the research is showing that by 1 year out after college in their jobs, men are already earning 7 to 15% more than women. Now, when you extrapolate that out during the course of a career, women are leaving tens of thousands of dollars on the table. And so women really need to get comfortable learning to negotiate. And if you don't know how to do it, it's a skill like anything else. Take a class. Take a workshop. Learn to negotiate. Get a coach that'll teach you how to negotiate. But learn to negotiate, because your whole life you're negotiating for something. If it's not for money, it's for a job that you want. If it's not for a job that you want, it's for an assignment that you'd like to have, or a boss you'd like to work with, or not having your mother-in-law stay for 3 months when you're trying to work. I mean, everything's a negotiation, so that'd be number one. Number two is simply not asking. Women believe, and we saw this happen with, was it the CEO from Microsoft, where he said, you know, he was asked the question, I think it was at a annual meeting, financial meeting, and he was asked the question, what do women really need to do to get ahead here? What could we be doing for ourselves? And he said, just keep working hard, and you'll be recognized for it. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a fallacy. He took a lot of heat over this. I don't know if it was Steve Ballmer. I don't remember who it was. But he took a lot of heat for it. Because the fact is that hard work does not get you ahead. Hard work lets you keep your job. What gets you ahead is focusing on what's the next job you want to have and positioning yourself for it and asking for it. So women need to learn to ask for the things that they want. Sometimes it's also asking for help. It could be asking for more staff. It could be asking for a bigger budget. And so a lot of times women will, you know, when we talk about making miracles, they get more done with less money, fewer resources, fewer people than should be humanly possible. But when a miracle needs to be made, men delegate it to a woman, because that's what they tell me. Because I'll ask men, what do you do when your boss asks you to make a miracle? And one of the things, they usually say three things. Number one, I negotiate. Number two, I laugh. Number three, I delegate it to a woman. Wow. So that's the other thing, is about asking. And then the third thing would be to assume equality. Women don't assume equality because they look around and they see so often women aren't treated equally. So if they see people aren't treated equally, they act as if they're not equal, and then they're not treated as if they're equal, and it becomes a vicious cycle. So I have this saying that's called act as if. And what that means is act as if you're absolutely equal to everyone else in the room. And I don't care if the CEO is in the room. I don't care if the janitor is in the room. You are going to act as if you belong with everyone else who's at the table, because you do. And at first, it may feel a little awkward because you feel like, oh, who am I to be talking to the CEO like this? Well, who are you? You're somebody that's being paid, probably being paid well, to think, to add value, and that's who you are. And that gives you the right to speak up. So those would just be three things right off the top of my head.
And so what does the life of a world-famous women's executive coach look like? What do you spend most of your time doing?
Oh, my. Every day is different. You know, when I called to make a doctor's appointment, they always say, well, you know, which day and time is best for you? And I would go, every day is different than every day. But I can tell you that my life is kind of divided into four parts. One is my work on my speaking. So it's about working with clients, developing keynote presentations, traveling to do them. And, you know, I probably do that about 25% of the time. Another 25% of the time, I have a coaching business, as you know, Corporate Coaching International. And I don't do so much coaching anymore, but it is devoted to managing that and working with the people who go out and do the coaching now. Another 25% of my day is usually spent, and this is aside from answering emails, which we all know could take the whole day if you let it. The other 25%, I have a nonprofit organization called the Bloom Again Foundation, and we provide rapid response financial assistance to working women who live at the poverty level when they miss work due to medical challenges. And so I spend about 25% of, you know, my time writing grant proposals and doing fundraising for Bloom Again. And then, you know, hopefully 25% of my life is spent on me and my family and just the things I enjoy most. So that's really how my time is divided up.
So the name of this podcast is how did you become so awesome? And what we wanted to know is, was there, I mean, you're a very successful author and you've got many, as you said, you've got your own not-for-profit and many different things going on in your life. Was there a tipping point for you or a moment where you knew, I want to be a leader and an advocate for women?
Well, I have to tell you, it was after Nice Girls Don't Get the Corner Office came out. That, you know, when I was in college, I took women's studies classes, and I was an advocate for women in all kinds of ways. I was a dorm director in women's dorms very early in my career on campuses. And so, you know, I was always an advocate, but I wasn't really a leader, just an advocate. And then what I realized, that there's no money to be made in women's causes, unless I guess you're Gloria Steinem. You know, there's no money to be made in women's causes. So my career path took me on one of working in human resources and then becoming an executive coach, consultant. But I worked mostly with men, because you have to remember that companies that are going to pay for your services, they're usually investing in men. They're not investing in women so much, particularly back when I was doing this. And so I'd say 80% of the time I was working with men, 20% of the time I was working with women. But then when Nice Girls Don't Get the Corner Office came out and it made all the bestseller lists, all of a sudden she's a woman's coach. And she's an advocate for women and she's a spokesperson for women. And, you know, at first I resisted it, to tell you the truth, because I thought, well, here I have this whole business that works mostly with men. What is a man going to think? And then I had a good conversation with a mentor of mine, and she said, Lois, take it. You need to understand that your brand has changed and that this is what it's become. And it's a great brand to be an advocate for women, so embrace it and make it work for you. And that's exactly what I did. And so it was really about 12 years ago that I shifted and I started focusing almost exclusively on women's issues.
Wow, I didn't know that that was part of the evolution of Dr. Lois Frankel.
Oh yeah, it was a definite evolution.
Yeah, wow. So what are some of the biggest challenges you faced on this road, and do you have any philosophies that you could share with us that you found have been particularly helpful?
Yeah, you know, some of the challenges that I faced is, and you know, it was fairly easy for me to write Nice Girls Don't Get the Corner Office because I made a lot of the mistakes that were in the book. It wasn't just that I saw other people making them. I made them too. I always say that I'm a recovering nice girl. And so we never quite, if we are nice girls, we never quite lose it. You know, I have to always tell myself to act like an adult woman and ask for what you want. So some of the challenges along the way were things like negotiating and not being embarrassed to talk about money and not being embarrassed to walk away when somebody offers me too little money. And so I made some mistakes along the way. I will never forget having, it was a dinner with a client, and it was around the holidays, and I was taking him out to thank him for his business, and we both had a couple of drinks, and he said, after a couple of drinks, he said, you know, I've been meaning to talk to you about your fees. How about if you lower your fee and, you know, whatever? Now, I didn't know what to say. I was a new consultant. I wasn't prepared for that conversation, and somehow I agreed to it.
Oh, no.
Now, today that would never happen, trust me, because first of all, I wouldn't have had a couple of drinks with the client. I learned my lesson. And second of all, I would say, oh, I'd be happy to lower the fee. What services would you like me to reduce along with it? Because that's how I've learned to negotiate, is to say, you know, if my price doesn't meet your requirements or your budget, I can bring the price down, but that means the services also go down with it. So let's talk about what you really want. So, you know, I think that whole thing about asking and negotiating and talking about money and just not being intimidated in a group of men. It's just not feeling one bit of intimidation. I'm finally not intimidated when I'm in a group of men. I really feel as if I can hold my own. Part of that is learning new skills. Part of that's just age, I think.
Yeah, I've gone back and read your book. I'm listening to it on an audiobook, and I'm about halfway through it the second time around, and I'm hoping that, I know that a lot of the teachings are good for theory, but you really have to internalize them and remember them, because they're kind of really hard and challenging for women to take on.
Well, they really are, and that's why I tell women to just take like little baby steps. Mm. You know, when you asked about what philosophy I have, you know, one of the philosophies I have is that if people knew better, they'd do better. We can't judge people by what they're doing in the moment, really. The fact is that everybody's doing the best they can. I think it was Plato who said, be kind, for everyone is fighting a hard battle. And so, you know, I don't want to be judgmental about people, but what I want people to understand is that you can take small baby steps to success. So, for example, if you have a difficult time negotiating, start negotiating with in a small situation when you return something to the store and they say, no, you're not allowed to, you know, bring it back without a receipt. And learn to negotiate and say, hey, look, I didn't keep the receipt because I didn't expect to get inferior merchandise. So let's talk about how both of our needs can get met. Start in small ways to negotiate so that you can work your way up to asking for the salary you think you really deserve in a new job or a raise that you've earned. So just start and you take baby steps. It's like Lao Tzu said, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step.
I love that. We've just hit our section called the Final Five, where we ask you 5 questions submitted by podcast listeners. But I have hijacked the first question because I have a question of my own. I was originally trained as a scientist, and Beck and I now have the YouTube channel, Did Someone Say Science? But women are traditionally underrepresented in the field of science. Have you coached many women in the fields of science and technology, and are there any mistakes specific to this field?
You know, it's interesting. I did, when I was coaching, I did have a client that was in, it was a medical field, so it was kind of scientific. They were researchers. And I coached a lot of the women there. And the women there were not that much different than the women elsewhere. Because when I talk about not assuming equality, not asking for what you want, they were very similar in that regard. Now, you also have to think that they're also in a male-dominated field. So a lot of times what women scientists, engineers, in big groups of women want to do is they just want to blend in. They want to almost be invisible. And then that way they don't feel as if, oh, I'm the one woman in the group or one of two women in the group. Now, being invisible is not going to help your career. And that's why I go back to this whole thing of acting as if you belong at the table. And what that means, and here's a very simple tip that I used to give my clients who are scientists, because they're not used to doing this. I would say, in every single meeting you go to, I want you to be among the first 2 or 3 people to speak. And they'd kind of look at me, and I'd say, hey, listen, early speakers are seen as having self-confidence. I want people to see that you have self-confidence. And then what I want you to do is I want you to speak every 15, 20 minutes, if it's a long meeting, every 15 or 20 minutes thereafter, so that your presence is continually known. This is how people will take you seriously. This is how people won't look at you when they swear and say, oh, excuse me, because they'll know that you're an equal. Did that answer your question?
It did, actually. And it's really funny as you were saying it. I was thinking, you know, I read that tip originally in the book a few years ago, and I can like think of so many times when I've said, you know, I can't even think of a question to ask, but I'm going to go and ask something anyway, because people never think that's a stupid question. People just think, wow, she had something to say. So yes, that's a tip that I've actually used.
Well, yeah, and it doesn't even have to be a question. Sometimes, you know, one of the easiest things that you can do that will really help your career is support what someone else had to say. So if you speak first and you say, you know, I think to solve this science problem we need to do XYZ, if I were to just say, you know what, I'll second that and I can support that because I've had a similar experience. Now my voice is out there and I've built a relationship with someone who's valuable to me.
That's a really great tip. I've also hijacked the questioning. My question is kind of the same, but a bit different. I'm a filmmaker, and film directing in particular, and women working in film and television is another field where women are underrepresented. Why do you think this is, and do you think there's any ways that we can correct course?
Well, yeah, you know, they tend to be, I think, more underrepresented, especially in union jobs. Like, I was talking to a woman the other day that, I don't know if she was a camera person or it was something, you know, in many levels of the entertainment field, there's a lot of union jobs. Mm. And those union jobs, it's an old boys club. Mm. And it's hard for the women to get in. Is that your experience?
Probably because I don't work in America usually, but I guess I meant like in directing people and things like that. I suppose maybe because women aren't used to delegating or being in those leadership roles.
Well, yeah, okay, if you're thinking about directors and things like that, it's only been recently that we have been seeing more women get into this. And you have to remember that those are positions of power and authority. And women have not traditionally wanted to step up into those positions because it's tough being a director, right? It's tough. And yes, you do have to tell people what to do and how to. I mean, you talk about a director, that's tougher than being a manager in a corporation, if you ask me, because there's millions and millions of dollars resting on how an actor says one line or two lines, like, you know, go ahead, make my day, or whatever it may be, right? There's millions and millions of dollars potentially resting on this, and I think women traditionally have not stepped up to those. Now we're seeing more women wanting to step up to it, but they're hitting the glass ceiling in a similar way that we saw women in corporations hit that glass ceiling, that the people who have the power to make the decisions for who will get the jobs tend to be Caucasian men. And so they're giving the jobs to other Caucasian men. Now, in corporations, we've seen that shift a little bit, that women have broken through the glass ceiling. They still need to break through the glass treehouse, up into CEO roles and boards of directors and so forth. But in the entertainment industry, it has almost been, it's been tolerated. You know, this kind of sexism has been tolerated, because you have individual investors and you're not getting, like, you know, in corporations, you get federal contracts and then the government dictates how many women, how many people of color you have to hire. That hasn't happened in those roles in entertainment. So it's difficult, but, you know, there are some silver linings here. You look at some at the top of some of the entertainment industries, you know, Sherry Lansing. You know, she ran Paramount for years. So things are changing. But again, women have to get comfortable with stepping up and asking and being in these leadership roles. Women, you know, it was interesting, now that you say that, you know, they made a pilot of Nice Girls Don't Get the Corner Office, and there was a woman director on that.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and it was very, and she was a fairly well-known director. I think it was Gail Parent. I'm not sure, but first name was Gail. And so it was a while ago that this happened. And so, you know, things are changing, but you do have to step up, you have to ask, and you have to build the relationships, because people give jobs to others that they know and they trust. And if you don't have the relationship in place, it's already too late to build the relationship when you want something. So, you know, networking is a big part of it too.
Just before we get on to question three, I wanted to ask a follow-up question to that one. How do you build relationships in an area where it's traditionally an old boys club and you see white men giving, or Caucasian men giving jobs to other Caucasian men? How can women kind of break into an area where that's the norm?
You know, I think it's one bite of the apple at a time, right? That you can't swallow a whole apple. You have to bite it a little bit off at a time and chew it. And so what I tell women is, don't try to insinuate yourself into men's groups. Do it one man at a time. Because if you build solid one-on-one relationships, these people will be advocates for you in the long run. And you humanize yourself to them. You don't just become, you know, men can get into groupthink when there's a bunch of them and then there's one or two women. And so you want to break out, you want to break through that, and you break through that by building these individual, one-on-one, warm, collegial relationships. And you do it by asking them about themselves, getting to know them, who they are as people, letting them know who you are as a person without TMI, okay? You cannot be given out too much information. Men don't want to hear it. But you can talk about what you might like from them and how they might be able to help you. Get yourself some male mentors. So many times women just focus on getting female mentors. Get yourself some male mentors. And in that process, you will find you'll soon be included in things. But, you know, it's a process. It takes a little time.
That's a good answer. I'm going to segue to question number 3 from Ed in Savannah. And he asks, should the corner office be our benchmark? How about owning the company, or how about working from a laptop on the beach?
The corner office is just a metaphor for getting exactly what you want in life. And it could be that you are the CEO of a major corporation. It could be you own your own enterprise and you work from home and you love it. It could be you are working for the beach, from the beach in Tahiti or wherever in Hawaii. So it is really just a metaphor for getting exactly what you want. Because a lot of times people do say to me, I don't really want the corner office, I just want more.
Yeah.
Well, then that is your corner office.
Yeah. I agree. We don't work in traditional corporate environments, and the book has been very helpful for us. Now, the fourth question is from my mum in Adelaide, Australia, and her name is Chris, and she wants to know, how can women market themselves in the workplace without sounding too self-absorbed?
Oh, I love Adelaide.
Have you been there?
Wow. I was just there this summer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I did a keynote for Business Chicks. Do you know Business Chicks?
Oh, yeah, I do. Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, no one ever says they love Adelaide.
Yeah,
oh, I loved Adelaide. I loved it. I've been there a couple times, actually. But anyway, so how do you market yourself? There is a wonderful book that I'm going to give a couple answers here. First, there's a wonderful book that's called Brag, The Art of Tooting Your Own Horn Without Blowing It, by Peggy Klaus, K-L-A-U-S. And I suggest that people read that, because she really does talk about how can I market myself without sounding like I'm full of myself. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. Number two is to wipe out, oh, it was nothing, from your vocabulary. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes marketing yourself is about accepting the compliments and letting people see that you know you did a good job, so that rather than say, oh, it was nothing, you know, we got lucky on that project, is being able to say something like, let me just think for a second, being able to say something like, thank you for noticing. I actually worked very hard on it, and I was pleased with how it came out, and it thrills me to no end that you're pleased too. Now, that doesn't sound like I'm full of myself. That just sounds like I'm appreciative that you noticed my efforts. But I didn't say it was nothing. And then a third way to market yourself is, this is about, I'd say about maybe about 3 or 4 weeks before your performance review, if you work in a corporation, before your performance review, you want to send your boss a summary of your key accomplishments during the review period, past review period. So if it's been a year or 6 months, what have your key accomplishments been in those past 6 months? And you just bullet them, and you send it to your boss with a little note that says, I know performance reviews are coming up, and I wouldn't expect you to remember everything that I've achieved, so I'm hoping this is helpful to you. Now, that's a way to market yourself without boasting. So there's ways to do it. You know, erase, oh, it's nothing from your vocabulary. Read the Klaus book, and make sure you tell your boss what you're doing.
That's really, really good advice. Number 5 and final question is from Helen in Melbourne, and she asks, what can parents do to support their young daughters?
Oh, okay. Let me start with, and I was just in Melbourne also. I did. It was the Australia Human Resources Institute, AHRI, did their annual conference there.
Oh, great.
And so a shout out to them in case they're listening, and we will make sure that they hear this, because we'll put it up, we'll tweet it, right?
Yes, we will let them know.
And good to know that the women of Australia are fans of your work as well.
Oh, yeah, I have a lot on Twitter, a lot of Australians. Okay, so what are we going to do for children, girls? How do we raise our daughters specifically to be leaders and to be self-confident? You're going to buy the book, Nurture by Nature. That's Nurture by Nature. The authors are Tiger, T-I-E-G-E-R, and Tiger, T-I-E-G-E-R, husband-wife team. And in this book, it talks about how you have to recognize your child's personality and their tendencies. and their preferences, and how you have to honor those if you want to raise self-confident children. Because the fact is that many times parents want to clone their children. For example, I had a mother who was very outgoing, and she expected me to be that outgoing, and I just wasn't. And so, you know, for many, many years, I felt inadequate because I couldn't live up to that expectation. It just wasn't comfortable for me to be as outgoing as she was. So, I mean, can you imagine what I could have done if I felt self-confident at a younger age? That would be number one, is to read that book, to teach your children, to teach you how to recognize your children's natural preferences so that you can honor them. Something else, get your daughters enrolled in self-defense classes. It's not so much just to teach them that they can defend themselves, but having a strong body leads to having a strong mind. And when you know you can defend yourself, you know you can do anything. So at a young age, do that. At a young age, start teaching your daughters about money. If you're going to give your child a dollar for an allowance, you teach them, okay, of that dollar, we're going to put $0.25 into savings for a rainy day. We're going to give 25 cents of that dollar to people who are less fortunate than we are. We're going to put 25 cents of that dollar into an account that you are not going to touch until you're a very old lady. You're going to invest it. And the other 25 cents, you can do whatever you want. Money is power. We need to teach our daughters how to invest and spend money so that they can be powerful financially. And then the last thing that I would suggest, and in my book, See Jane Lead, by the way, I have a whole chapter on how to raise your daughters to lead, with lots more ideas. But the last thing is, consider enrolling your daughter in an all-girls school. All the research shows that girls who go to all-girls schools are more likely to become leaders later in life than girls who go to co-ed schools. And so if you can afford it, if you can find one, if it's possible, really consider getting your daughter in an all-girls school.
Wow, I never knew about that research. We'll have to look it up. And I also love how you are really supportive of other authors in the space and recommend, and you know all the books that are out there.
And we'll put some links to those books in the show notes as well.
Okay, that's great. That'd be perfect.
Okay, so that completes the final five. But before we wrap up, what's coming up for you in the future? What are you working on?
You know, I'm working on a new book. Next year, I'm going to take a little bit of a sabbatical, now that I've been working my whole life. I'll still be doing some keynotes. But what I'm really going to do is drive across the United States, and I am going to stop and talk to women who are in their 80s, 90s, 100, and I am working on a book that's called Words of Wisdom from Wise Old Women. And I'm calling it the Wise Old Women Project. And I want to learn from them, what do they know from all of their years of living that they'd like to share with younger people? And I'm going to incorporate my love of photography in this by taking pictures of many of them and then putting it together in a book that will benefit my nonprofit, Bloom Again Foundation. And that's what I hope to do.
That is a fantastic project. I'm really looking forward to buying a copy when it comes out. Where's the best place for listeners to find you online?
Oh, you know, I Twitter at Dr. Lois Frankel. I am Dr. Lois Frankel on Facebook. I have a web page, website, drloisfrankel.com. So all you really have to do is Google Dr. Lois Frankel, and all of these things will come up. Now, I say doctor, not to be boasting here, but rather because there is a Lois Frankel who's a legislator in Florida, and it's just to distinguish us, that's all.
Oh, right, right. But also, you are a doctor, so you're not boasting.
No, that's right. See, now look what I did. I was a nice girl.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Lois. It's been wonderful. Thank you for all that you've done for women and girls through all your work and your foundational work as well.
And thank you. Well, we want to thank you from a personal note, because it's your book that has helped shape my career. So I don't think we'd be interviewing you and be in this position today if it wasn't for the work that you wrote. So thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the kind words. I appreciate the interview, and I appreciate you encouraging other women to follow suit.